Now we look back at some of the year's biggest science stories. Last week we dug into one of Discover Magazine's top 10 about a rewrite of the human evolution timeline. Now we'll check out some of the other big stories, including one that may have eclipsed the rest. Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine, and Bill Andrews is a senior associate editor at Discover. They're both based in Waushaw. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Always great to be with you.
And Bill, good to have you with us.
Thanks. You too.
Well, I spoiled it a little bit there. Your number one story for the year, for a variety of reasons, was the big solar eclipse on August 21st. Bill, how did that make it to the top of the list?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was a little bit controversial in our offices this year because it isn't kind of a big finding. It isn't something new that science uncovered this year, which is usually what we try to recognize with our number one spot. But after debating everything and looking at all the things that did happen this year, we ended up picking it just because it was such a big event. We'd been planning on some kind of eclipse coverage and having people out in the field and witnessing it for themselves for literally for years. This is such a big event, and I think over 200 million American adults ended up seeing this eclipse, this uniquely American eclipse that no other country got to see totality, so it felt like a nice, you know, America kind of, yeah, national pride with this eclipse. So it was just everywhere, all over the summer. Everything was leading up to this big eclipse in August. So we just felt like, yes, a moment where everyone could agree this is cool. And with all the other kind of bitterness, and it's been a tough year in a lot of ways, at least this was something that for a few minutes everyone agreed was really neat. They could just look up and see something or look online and see the whole show. And that's very rarely going to happen for something science-related. So we felt that, like, that was just so great.
And Bill, do you think that's something that stimulated people to be interested in the sun, the moon, and the stars, for that matter, outside of the eclipse day?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, maybe I'm just deluding myself because we want to believe that. But I feel like it got people really kind of curious about, well, you know, what is going on? Why is the sun going to kind of blot out for a little bit? What's happening? And the eclipse glasses, people were always excited to learn that, hey, you can use those anytime you want. Just put them on, and if they're the real safety eclipse glasses, you can just look at the sun and look at the sunspots, see how they move as the sun itself revolves any day of the year. And so people were, oh, yeah, no, that's cool. I think I will try that. So at least in my personal experience, I think it did stimulate some more. I think I will look into this whole space situation.
I still have my eclipse glasses sitting on my desk. We watched them here at our studio. I imagine you watched them over in Waukesha if you couldn't make the trip too, right?
Right. A lot of my coworkers, there was an event in the parking lot to make sure that whatever there was to see through the clouds and everything that day, that they would be seen. Although I did get to go out and see totality from out in Tennessee, as a bunch of my other colleagues also got to go out and see totality from all across the country. So even if you couldn't see the big show itself, it was still kind of a nice communal activity that a lot of people could get together and enjoy the sky.
And Gemma, I want to bring you in on one of the other stories in your top 100 list. This was not right up there in the sky in front of us, but still interesting. A tick fossilized in amber that has some really old blood in it. Tell us about this story. This is weird.
Yeah, well, this is it's super cool. It's not weird. It's awesome.
They weirdly have awesome, Gemma.
They have found the oldest mammalian red blood cells ever discovered, and they found them inside a tick that was encased in amber. Obviously, you know, it was resin back in the day, and then over time it became amber. But yeah, this tick was encased in it, and they actually found legitimate red blood cells still inside the tick. And they think what happened was a primate was grooming another primate, found the tick, and just, you know, picked it off and flicked it, and it landed in the tree resin. So the really cool thing is they think this, it's at least 15 million years old. It could be as old as 45 million years. And there's an update since we put this story in the magazine. It's pretty exciting. They have even more recently found a 99-million-year-old piece of amber with an engorged tick inside of it. And another tick found in a related piece of amber, so just as old, 99 million years old, was holding on to a dinosaur feather. And what's cool about this is we're finding these ticks that are older and older and older, whether it be the one with red blood cells like we found, or scientists found earlier in the year, or this other more recent find with the 99-million-year-old ticks. And the great thing is we don't know that much about ticks, exactly when they evolved. So we are actually seeing researchers build the tick family tree further back in time. And, you know, I know, nobody likes ticks. They're gross. But it is really cool science happening right now.
Right. So we, apart from learning that ticks were a nuisance 15 million and 99 million years ago, can we take this blood and learn something about that and about the primates, I guess, that this tick was bothering?
Yeah. You know, not so much with the dinosaur material, the ticks that were preying on dinosaurs. And that's just because of a number of factors in the preservation of the amber itself. But with this other find, the 15 to 45 million year old find, where they have confirmed there are mammalian red blood cells in there. I mean, they already know they're from a mammal, and that's by the shape of the blood cell. So they're hoping to do further research and really figure out a way to look inside those cells in a way that's not destructive. Unfortunately, a lot of the methods that researchers use to really get inside these kinds of specimens, it destroys them, and obviously you don't want to destroy it. So they're kind of nosing around, trying different things, seeing what they can see without actually destroying the specimen.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak and Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine. They're based in Waukesha, and we're looking at some of the big news in science, technology, and math from 2017. And Bill, the field of mathematics doesn't always enter the field of politics. This year it did. It's relevant to Wisconsin. What kind of mathematical procedures are we talking about here?
Right. And this is an extra fun one because a lot of people think math, oh, I'll never use that in the real world. It's just a bunch of people with their head in the clouds. But this story actually shows that it can have real world consequences for everybody. And so what happened was there basically, in a nutshell, mathematicians came up with a formula to determine if gerrymandering has occurred in terms of drawing unfair district lines in determining government representation. And so right there, I mean, after ticks, probably people hate politics even more, talking about politicians. But
can't say politics without tick.
Yes, that's exactly right. So this is one of those things that mathematicians had to get their hands dirty a little bit and work with the real world. But by altering the very at minute levels, including an extra street or an extra house or an extra neighborhood here, they would the formula works by running simulations of votes and tweaking these district lines just a little bit. And if things were fair to begin with, those little tweaks shouldn't really make a big difference. But if they find that tweaking, making those little tweaks actually does result in different results for the elections, you know something was up at the very beginning. So this is something that can apply to a current court case with Pennsylvania, I believe, but I know Wisconsin also has some skin in the game when it comes to redistricting and possible gerrymandering. So now that there's an actual unbiased, scientific, mathematical way to highlight this, hopefully it'll be a way, it'll clear a path going forward and help the courts determine if this has actually happened or not.
Gemma, I want to turn to another. There's a lot we can get to. We won't get to it all. I want to go to Antarctica now, Gemma.
So do I.
And you've been there.
We all.
I haven't. You've been to Antarctica, right?
Yes, sir.
So the new news here is when we think of Antarctica, if we sang a song about it, we think we'd be singing about ice, but it turns out would be a song of ice and fire. There are a lot of volcanoes under Antarctica, we're learning.
Yes, yes. And, you know, we knew that there were volcanoes under Antarctica. In fact, when I lived there for 22 months, I was living on the island where we have Mount Erebus. And that is actually the southernmost active volcano in the world. So we knew there were volcanoes there, but what I love about this story is we're still finding out things about our planet that we thought we knew, but it turns out, actually, they have found more than 90 brand new, previously unidentified volcanoes in the West Antarctic Rift System. And that's basically an area where plate tectonics are just ripping the continent continent apart. It's kind of similar what's happening in Iceland. You know, the European plate and the North American plate are pulling apart, and that's why Iceland has a lot of volcanoes. Well, the same thing is going on in Antarctica. We had no idea just how many volcanoes were there. So 91 previously unidentified volcanoes. And the big question is, you know, the ice sheets in Antarctica are thinning due to climate change. And the question is, how will the volcanoes affect the thinning of the ice sheets, and how will the thinning of the ice sheets affect the volcanoes? Bringing up Iceland again, there's evidence that as the ice sheets in Iceland thin during the Middle Ages, there was a definite uptick in volcanic activity. So the question is, are we going to see that same thing happen in Antarctica, and how will that affect these huge ice sheets that right now are covering all these volcanoes we had no idea were there?
And that could be kind of a feedback loop. Less ice, if there are more volcanic eruptions there, that could further change the climate, right?
Yes, yeah. It has a lot of implications, and it's one of those things that scientists, you know, we didn't even know the volcanoes were there. So now that they know that they're there, they are launching studies on a number of fronts to really try to understand what's happening and what the consequences may be.
We're looking back at some of the biggest science stories of 2017 with Gemma Tarlak and Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think was the top science story of the year? What have you been following, big or small, when it comes to stories from the worlds of science, technology, math? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our discussion now about the top science news of 2017 with Gemma Tarlak and Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think was the most important, interesting, or just plain cool science news from the last year? What was the biggest discovery? Call in with your suggestions now at 800-642-1234. Or if you've been involved in citizen science or research yourself, you can let us know that too. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Something I want to talk to you both about. Let's start with you, Bill. The Cassini probe in the Saturn area, the Saturn neighborhood, told us a lot. What were some of the big discoveries there?
Oh, I mean, almost everything that we currently know about Saturn and its moons, we learned from the Cassini mission. It left Earth about two decades ago, and just this year finally had to call it quits. Took a final swan dive into the atmosphere of Saturn itself, purely so that it wouldn't possibly contaminate some of the moons around Saturn, which we've since learned might actually be havens for life. I think that might be one of the more fascinating, interesting things that Cassini showed us, just how rife with possibility the solar system, and particularly Saturn's neck of the woods, is.
Yeah, Bill, what were the signs we saw on some of Saturn's moons that said, hey, you know, we obviously don't have the life itself, but there are conditions there that might work?
Right. In astronomy, all the scientists are always careful to say, no, we didn't see life, but signs consistent with a possibly habitable environment, which basically that's as close as we can come at this point. And in particular, the moon Enceladus was one of the most exciting finds for this, because astronomers knew that it existed. They knew it was small, relatively small and icy, like a lot of Saturn's moons. But after Cassini got there, we learned a lot more about this place, even colder than Antarctica. So one of the few places I think I know of that Gemma hasn't traveled to in her life.
Yet.
Yet, exactly. We don't know for sure, because Enceladus is so enticing. So it's got this icy crust, and beneath it a global ocean over the whole moon, astronomers think. And for years they've seen plumes of water shooting out of parts of the crust where there were openings. There were these beautiful-looking tiger stripes, is what the astronomers called them, where the crust was a little weaker, and you could see some of the insides of the planet, of the moon, excuse me, kind of slosh out. And over the years, Cassini was able to go through some of those plumes, actually taste the waters of this moon Enceladus. And it found that not only is it actual water, which you never know, it looked like water, but it found, yes, it's actual water. It's got organic compounds within it, and there's a chemical brew inside it that is similar to the kind that on Earth, the bacteria at hydrothermal vents eat. So the conditions in Enceladus, it's got water, it's got a source of energy in Saturn right nearby, and ultimately the sun, and it's got the materials that could possibly lend some kind of life existence. So until we have a better view of this place, it looks like, all the check marks are checked off. Maybe life could actually exist there.
And Gemma, with this story and those Antarctic volcanoes, I think definitely I've thought a lot of times, oh, all the cool science is done. We're just kind of picking up the details. And clearly that's wrong. We're still finding new stuff all the time.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the favorite things about my job is that I get to watch this happen. And it's just, you know, sometimes it's really spine tingling.
In a good way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak and Bill Andrews from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the big stories in the world of science. We'll go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Richard is with us in Cambridge. Richard, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What's your big story for 2017?
Well, it's the saddest story I can think of, and it's the complete denial of science by the United States. By, of course, our leader, and then apparently everybody... at least on one side of the aisle, seems to support what they know is untrue.
And any particular parts of science you're concerned about?
Well, let's talk about the most obvious one that they're most vocal about, and that's climate science.
Gotcha. Richard, thanks for the call. And Gemma, there were climate change-related stories in your top 100, and you also talk about, and we talked about this last week a little bit, concerns about science and scientific research in 2017. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, this is really an unprecedented year in terms of the new administration coming in and refocusing their science goals and science aims, and also in some cases going directly against the recommendations of scientists, not just on climate change, that was obviously a huge, huge factor, but things like banning certain pesticides that we know are carcinogenic, and that a total ban was about to be enacted, and it was decided by this administration to put that on hold. And there are a number of other instances as well. Again, in a number of fields, there were recommendations for a particular species to be listed as endangered and given the protections that that entails. And again, this was a recommendation from the agency's own scientists, and it was decided not to protect that species. So we have a timeline, and Richard, I don't know if you're still on the line. I hope you are, and I hope you pick up the magazine and check out our number 4 story this year, because we felt it was very important to keep our readers informed on all these changes. And I want to say not all the changes have been negative. In fact, it's been really heartening to see a lot of scientists really embracing this opportunity to make their voices heard, to speak publicly, to run for office. We've seen a lot of citizens, ordinary citizens. You know, there were 1 million people out around the world in April for the March for Science, about 100,000 of them in Washington, D.C., people coming out and making their pro-science voices heard. And that, to me, was hugely heartening. So we do have a timeline. We will be putting an extended version online soon, but right now in our magazine, in our print magazine, we do have a timeline outlining a number of the really unprecedented changes that directly affect science policy and future research.
Richard, thanks a lot for that call. I want to get to another story or two in your top 100. Bill, let's check out, let's go further away than Saturn now. A star system with 7 Earth-ish sized planets in it. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this is in the field of exoplanets, as they say, worlds beyond our solar system. And we've been finding a few here or there the last few years, and it's always kind of neat, and we're getting closer to finding what I think is the true end goal for a lot of people, an actual Earth analog, where it's a planet that resembles Earth enough that we could imagine life as we know it being there. And so this year we made a pretty big step towards that in the sense of this system called the TRAPPIST-1 system that has 7, like you said, 7 Earth-ish-sized worlds, which is the most we've ever found at once before. Only 3 of them are in the habitable zone where liquid surface water might exist, but even so, that's 3 already. And even more enticing and tantalizing about these They all orbit very close to one another, some closer than Earth is to the moon. So there's an idea in astronomy of panspermia, where maybe a comet strikes a planet that has life on it, and then some of the detritus ejected from that planet, some of the rocks thrown off, has bacteria or other life on it, and then that can act as a seed for other worlds. And it actually, papers have come out saying that's completely plausible here in this TRAPPIST-1 system, among some of these worlds that are so close together. So definitely a site that astronomers will be keeping an eye on in the future.
Well, we got through a lot of your list, Gemma. Very briefly, just 20 seconds or so, some promising cancer research.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. So the FDA has finally approved CAR-T therapy. I should say CAR-T therapy has finally arrived. This is such a new and very important, very promising direction in ways to knock cancer down for good. And the great thing is this first drug is going to help a lot of children and young adults. So I can explain how it works, but not in 20 seconds, buddy. What are you going to do?
Gemma, I will thank you for joining us and look forward to talking to you again is what I'll do. Thanks, Gemma.
Thank you.
And Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, too.
We've been talking to Bill Andrews and Gemma Tarlak. They're both with Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, looking at some of the top stories in the year in science.